18th episode of Gamers Footnotes with two S's. Our email address, as always, is gamersfootnotes@gmail.com, and our web address is gamersfootnotes.com. So that should be easy to remember, both with two S's, as I'm obligated to say as Steven stares at me. I'm your host, JT, along with my co-host, Steven.
Hello, everybody.
And today we're going to talk to y'all a little bit about our series of character tropes. And the first one we're going to look at is villains, as they're an essential part of gaming history and often are the characters people remember the most. And then in our little short segments down the line, I'm going to talk about what I deem to myself as No Man's Land, which are games that aren't quite old enough to be retro fun, but aren't quite new enough to be new. So, tantalizing, I know.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the Humble Bundles, which many gamers are familiar with as sort of a mixture of charity and a way to get cheap games, and with particular note to the recent opening of the Humble Store, which is selling newer games at full price, also with a portion of the proceeds going to charity.
So Steven's going to have the worthwhile short segment, so we will attempt to shortchange mine and move on to that. But turning on to our main thing, one of the things that we kind of alluded to in our Gaming as Art series is sort of the artistic elements and tropes of video game characters. And this is a ground that you're starting to see more people look at for a lot of different reasons, one of which is it's always the first thing of art, which is to look at the characters that comprise a piece. That's true from paintings to plays to musicals to operas to movies to novels. People remember the characters in it. And make no mistake, almost everything has a character to it. And you see a lot of talk about sexism in games, which is a topic I'm sure we'll get around to sometime. Different class inequalities, racial inequalities, sexual orientation inequalities, pretty much all a reflection of society into games. And one of the first places we thought to start was with villains, because they pretty much make up one half of the gaming population. For every Mario, there is a Bowser. And for a lot of times, the villains tend to be more interesting than the good guys because more can be said about them.
Well, especially since oftentimes the protagonist is the player, and so you're meant to kind of put yourself into that. We tend to like to think of ourselves as generally pretty good. The villain is the foil, and so oftentimes there will be a great deal more characterization to the villain because they are not a stand-in for the player. They are the sand on which the pearl of the player's experience is built, so to speak, the irritant. And so that opens up a lot of doors. You can tell a lot of story about how the villain got to be what they are, why they are so opposed to whatever it is the protagonist is doing. And then depending on the story, you may also go in other directions. For instance, sometimes the villain has no idea who the protagonist is, doesn't really care. The villain is something much greater, or looking at a much larger picture. You see this in games where the villain is sometimes an entire church or a corporation or something else. Even then, though, generally the villain will also take the form of a person within that organization. You see that in games like Final Fantasy, where you could extrapolate. I'll use Final Fantasy X, a game about ultimately how the church for this continent is in fact being run by people who do not have others' best interests at heart. And even though it is the entire church that is the villain, it ends up getting personified in the form of Seymour, who is a high-ranking official within that church. You see it in Final Fantasy VII with Shinra and either Rufus or his father, or Sephiroth, who is ultimately an employee of Shinra until he goes totally crazy. These organizational evils are interesting because they normally get distilled down into a single point, but also they allow to be the story to be told from sort of two levels, the planet versus Shinra and also Cloud versus Sephiroth.
And that's a very good point. The Wing Commander series was set up that way. It was, you know, the Earth, the Terran Confederacy versus the Kilrathi. And then eventually it distilled all the way down to when they gave the protagonist a name, Colonel Blair versus Prince Thakrath. I totally mispronounced that. But it's a cat name, who cares?
Right.
And he sort of became the personification of the Kilrathi culture, down to one character, so it was you against him. And one of the interesting things is sort of how villains evolved, and I'd like to sort of take a sidestep for a moment, and I haven't meant to ask you this beforehand, but have you seen Wreck-It Ralph?
Yes.
It's sort of an interesting commentary on video game villains, a lot more than video game protagonists, as we tend to celebrate Mario and then forget about Bowser. Or, in this case, it's pretty clear that the first character was Mario and the second character he was Donkey Kong, who actually ultimately evolved into a hero. So, I mean, on some levels, it was kind of interesting to see a movie transform a villain to a hero after the video game industry transformed the same character into a hero on their own. I think a lot of people forget that Mario's first villain was Donkey Kong.
Right.
And then once Donkey Kong Country hit, Donkey Kong then became a hero.
An environmentalist hero.
Yeah, exactly. And so you do see that, even though the movies tried to make it seem like a novel idea, that you do see the villains have transformed to good guys as game series become more popular, because as we talked about last week, who doesn't love a good redemption story?
And you do. You see, Wreck-It Ralph is kind of interesting to sort of use for this conversation, because they did have so many actual villains within the game, and it was fun to see sort of Zangief's opinion on how Street Fighter evolved, though I'm not sure how many people realize Zangief is actually one of the bad guys in the Street Fighter. Sometimes that gets lost in fighting games, so the story tends to be a little bit...
Well, Zangief is an interesting... We'll start with Zangief as sort of a character study. He did sort of evolve, but he was always a player's choice character. So that sort of separated him out from the true villains of Street Fighter II, which were Vega, M. Bison, Balrog, and Sagat. But he was sort of, quote, one of the evil guys you could play because he was a communist. But in the later games, he sort of made him more into a joke character than anything else. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
You know, I had in my head that he was one of the bad guys, but I may have made that up. I haven't played Street Fighter in a long time. You see this in other media too, where you have the capitalism versus communism, Rocky versus the Russian guy whose name I can't remember.
Drago.
All right, there you go. And so oftentimes in games as well, you're going to see these stand-ins for these much greater concepts, and that's kind of what happened there. And so maybe it was just extrapolated that he was a bad guy purely because, well, he happened to be Russian, and there were still, for people who are too young to remember this, a certain amount of tension. Well, it's coming back, so there you go. But at the time, there was still substantial tension between the former Soviet republics and mostly the United States, but presumably also other capitalistic countries. I actually don't know how the rest of the world felt about that. I have a sort of limited American perspective on the late 90s.
Street Fighter would be an interest. That was one of the things that's always interested me that I don't have a great answer to, was because the world warriors, in quotes, were from different regions, how different people viewed the characters. I always kind of thought there was supposed to be more of a rivalry between Ryu and Ken that I don't think really came through on the American side, on whether or not Ken was supposed to be good, bad, evil, indifferent. He just sort of was rich and blonde.
And that's all you need.
And that's really pretty much what America is.
All right, well, there you go.
But to get back to the point, Street Fighter's one of those interesting games where the villains are usually pretty clearly defined. I mean, M. Bison has almost no redeeming social characteristics whatsoever. He pretty much wants power and doesn't really care to stop it. As the series sort of evolves, that's been one of the more interesting things, is he's become a less popular character to the franchise because he's a one-trick pony. And I think you see that with a lot of video game villains, is they either evolve into something more complicated.
Bowser.
And I think Bowser's the quintessential example of it, or they get replaced by a bad guy who's essentially the same thing, but it's just bigger, better, and stronger.
The Dragon Ball Z model.
Yeah, exactly. And what makes you a better bad guy than the last bad guy is, well, you beat up the last bad guy.
Exactly.
So, therefore, you must be more evil.
Or you beat up someone who in turn beat up the last bad guy. It's not really hard to understand why that happens. Some games really just want you to have, okay, this is who you're fighting. Especially older games. Like in Double Dragon, you have the cartel, were they a cartel or were they just a gang? Anyway, you have the people you are trying to defeat. It's not super important why that is. They're evil, therefore they've got it coming. That's all you actually need to know. Mario was like that. You needed to have some sort of dragon thing for him to fight. You know, it was a castle, so we're going to have a dragon, and we're going to make the dragon a little bit more turtly as we go.
Because turtles are apparently the most evil thing in Japan.
Right? That's a weird... But anyway...
Somebody needs to explain that to me at some point.
Turtles are dangerous, what can I say? are the closest thing we have to turtles here are armadillos, and they spread leprosy. So
no, that's all the point.
There you go. Bowser, however, as the games go, I think we've talked in a much earlier episode about how Mario sort of changed because we imprinted a story on the original Mario Brothers that was not really explicitly defined. And that doesn't really work for very long. Or as you start expecting more story, because, well, who is Mario? Why does he care about Peach? What's going on? Why can't Peach get, you know, a Brink's home security system or something so that she doesn't get captured every 2 to 3 days? This is, which is always my favorite story, and one they have addressed in the Paper Marios to a certain extent. But as Mario evolved, you also needed the villain to evolve, because if you have an interesting hero, but a villain who's just, well, you know, this is what I do, that really doesn't work. It's a mismatch on a kind of a... So not only did they evolve as becoming more like characters, but Bowser also evolved to be much more sympathetic, to kind of understand why he did what he did to a certain extent. He is just kind of a jerk, but best example is Super Mario RPG, where he's actually one of the playable characters, one of the good guys. And he's constantly crying because people don't like him or because people are mean to him. And so you kind of get this picture of someone who acts out because he just wants people to love him.
He's an outsider, always looking in.
Right. He never gets... Well, it's that, in some sense, is kind of the story of Wreck-It Ralph. It's like, yeah. He just wants people to appreciate what he does. Which is terrorize people, so it's not a perfect analogy to Wreck-It Ralph. But at the same time, it's what Bowser is. And so and you get the impression he really does like Peach, and he gets super upset that she doesn't say... You know, it's a story of unrequited love, and so that's what drives Bowser to his... dragon-like rages. And whether or not you buy into that at all, it was an evolution. It was a change because you need more interesting villains to deal with more complex characters. Sometimes that complexity, one kind of seeming counterexample that really isn't would be the Mass Effect games. The villains in that are just villains to the extent that, well, they want to destroy, they want to kill everyone. So it's hard to put, you know, a positive spin on mass genocide. The game tries it, I really wish it hadn't, by saying, well, you know, we have to do this or the universe will spin wildly out of control. Like, yeah, how about no? But putting that aside, the idea was, okay, so this is hugely evil and obviously we need to beat it. And for the most part, everyone realizes that. I don't think anyone seriously expects you to buy into, well, maybe they should wipe everything out. It asks the question, but really the way it asks it is, that's what they think, and they think that because they see so far beyond what humanity is capable of seeing on a geological time scale, and that's why you're not really supposed to empathize with that. So doesn't that show that you don't need complex villains to deal with a fairly complex hero? Well, two things. Shepard is not a particularly complex hero.
No.
But even with the complexities of... The complexity doesn't come from the villain so much as it comes from the complexity of trying to pull everyone... The complexity is fighting against human nature. That's, in many ways, what the Mass Effect games are about. The complexity to counter the depth of the hero is that he's not really fighting against the Reapers. The second and third games deal with that a lot. And like, well, I'm not, or the second game especially, not really fighting the Reapers. I'm fighting humanity and the other alien races because people don't want to believe things that they wish weren't true. They don't want to believe the worst. They don't want, and that's where the complexity came from. And so the villain, the problem with Mass Effect 3 is that you might inappropriately assign the Reapers to be, or Mass Effect 2 especially, the Reapers to be the villains. Well, the Reapers aren't really the villains. The understanding is if everyone bands together, they can beat the Reapers. The problem is they won't. And so the villain is sort of man's inhumanity to man. And so that was one of my favorite things about Mass Effect, is that it's really more an exploration of how bad things have to get people to cooperate, or how easy it is to just give up which is another theme it explores. Really, those were more the villains of the game in some sense.
And a lot of that got ported straight into Dragon Age, especially into Dragon Age Origins, which explored it in a probably an easier to relate way because it was all humans, in the sense of you basically saw that the undead horde was very clearly identified, but that didn't stop any of the other politics from happening. And the entire origin storyline was basically like, they will literally be on the front doorstep and people will still be bickering about their petty little differences. And sadly, they haven't really addressed that back yet again.
But again, the villain, you know, you had the non-complex villain, the Ravenous, or they're even more so than the Reapers. They don't even have a reason for what they're doing, as far as we know. It's just their nature. It's just what they do. They're zombies.
Yeah.
And oftentimes when you have zombie games, Resident Evil, the villain is not, even in Resident, even before you kind of know who Umbrella is, the villains in the game, even though all you tend to do are kill zombies, zombies are not really the villains. Umbrella is the villain, or more accurately, you know, this concept that, well, we can control people, or we can make people better, or whatever it is. Umbrella's had a lot of sort of mutually inconsistent aims throughout that series. But whatever it is Umbrella's trying to do, they're the bad guys, even though you don't really fight them. And that's not a particularly uncommon concept with villains in games. Final Fantasy is famous for not telling you who the real villain is, or letting you believe the real villain is one guy, and then it not having nothing to do with that person. My favorite example of that, again, the statute of limitations is long past, so stop listening now, but I am about to give major spoilers for Final Fantasy IX. Final Fantasy IX is a game that did not even hint who the villain was until after you got through what you already thought was the last boss battle. You had the fake villain that everyone expected, Kuja, and then it turned out it, well, okay, so now you've got kind of the powers that be behind him, okay, fine. And then you find out that none of that was actually what was going on, that it actually had to do with this world-ending force that believed that the, you know, universe should no longer exist. It was really quite independent from Kuja. It was just using him to sort of weaken everything up. Final Fantasy frequently does that. Square games in general frequently do that, where the villain is hidden, but it still works. It still achieves the foil by having kind of a greater villain. It's sort of the equivalent of hiding who is behind Shinra from the equation. Seven doesn't, really. I mean, you kind of know who's behind Shinra. But the idea is you can still have sort of that overarching evil, that existential threat, and then at the very end personify it down to one point so that you can have a satisfying boss battle and actually finish it, because let's not kid ourselves, you can't really fight Shinra. Shinra is a corporation. It's a series of buildings. There's not really an effective way to do anything about that. And so the nature of games to tell a story and to come to a conclusion necessitates that you then solidify this down to an apex villain.
And speaking of hiding the villain, my favorite example of that is the first Fallout game, where it looks on the surface that the main villain is the Master and his mutant army. And certainly they are an evil bad, but at the very, very end of the game, you find out the true villain in all of this is the Overseer. Because he understood that as soon as he sent you to go get the water chip, you were never coming back home. It was a suicide mission that he didn't tell you was a suicide mission. And that's pretty much the ending of the game. And I've always loved the fact that if you have a certain perk, then you just shoot him and then leave. Or you just leave. But at the end of the day, he's the main villain. Because there are a lot of different choices. He could have let you back in. It wasn't groundbreaking for what you did. You made the heroic sacrifice. Strongly implied that you ruined your health with all the radiation and risk life and limb. And then your reward was literally like, oh, yep, banishment. And there was no hint of that at all throughout the game.
No, the assumption was that you would be welcomed back. And it became clear with Fallout 2 why they had done it that way. As your character is sort of redeemed through the founding of Aroya, or the game is sort of redeemed. It's not as hopelessly depressing if you realize it goes on to live a fairly long life and start a community.
Sure, but you almost got that's out of necessity.
Right.
Far more than anything he ever intended. And, I mean, the beginning of the game, the Overseer's telling you what a hero you'll be and that you'll be welcome back.
The Overseer is the bad guy. But again, though, it did have sort of what I like about the Fallout games is that you kind of have a choice. You can have it where we need to distill Shinra down into someone you can beat up to defeat Shinra. Or you could go the other direction and say, nope, just can't win. And Fallout actually more goes that way because you do get asked the questions, well, who came up with the main plot points? Who came up with the virus? Well, right. All those people are dead. So you can't beat them. You can't do anything to them. This simply exists, and there's not really anything you can do about it. Like, well, that's not a very satisfying conclusion. Well, it's oftentimes how things actually work. There isn't that apex. There isn't a way to actually fight back because you never, well, assuming that you kind of go with the canon ending, you never get to kill the Overseer. You get the satisfaction of knowing that he gets killed when Dreadclaws, I think,
end up, yes,
destroying Vault 13. But, you know, ultimately robbing you of the chance to do it yourself, or one of your ancestors, or descendants, rather, to do it. Sometimes games do kind of take the approach that you can't really change this. The most recent Deus Ex, depending on the ending you choose, one of the kind of better endings is sort of embracing the fact that you can't really... Who do you fight to stop this? All right, what one person? Well, there is no one person you can fight to stop anything. And so it sort of questions the, well, who do you need to beat up on? You can beat up on, I've forgotten his name, but the closest they get, you can beat up on the guy who's decided.
Oh, the tyrant?
Yeah.
I forget his name. I hated that boss battle, by the way.
Yeah. But you can, you know, you can, or, you know, the guy who made the Arctic base.
Oh, yeah.
You can stop him, and so you can stop people from going crazy, but the endings don't really deal. I mean, whatever ending you choose, you stop people from going crazy, largely. The question is, the questions that are asked through the game, though, are, well, is it right to do this? Is it right to modify humanity to make people into cyborgs and things like that? Well, you don't really get a great answer to any of that, because how do you stop it? And, you know, the very name of the game implies... Evolution is largely, even if it's human-forced evolution as it is in Deus Ex, it's probably inevitable. Because once that Pandora's box has been opened, you're never getting anything back into it. So the question is how to guide the change, not how to stop it. Because you can't. And often games are a great vehicle to explore those sorts of things that are more difficult to address in the real world. What do you do with a problem that you can't stop? And so sort of these environmental villains, when the villain is human nature, the villain is greed. Games are a great vehicle to address how you can deal with the parts you can deal with, and how do you deal with the parts you can't deal with. And the parts you can deal with are individuals who take it to an extreme that is obviously wrong, and then guiding everyone else into the best solution, even if it's the best of a bunch of bad choices. Games allow us to explore that space through stories and through interaction, to kind of think through, well, what should happen here? And the Deus Ex game really did ask, well, what should happen here, and why do you think that should be the solution that we choose? Because there wasn't really, or at least for most of the endings, there wasn't really a right answer.
No, and I mean, that's been a hallmark of the series, is that it's like a lot like real life. You just really pick the lesser of all the evils, or whichever one you can live with.
And all games kind of end with the illusion of choice, because ultimately, you know, you are kind of on the rails. Even if no matter how well disguised the rails are, they are there. If you are within a game world, there are parameters. The Deus Ex games are interesting because they sort of use that confinement to show you there really aren't any other choices. I mean, that's, you know, kind of life is on the rails. They're only
right.
with these greater concepts, sometimes that's true. You know, you have a limited amount of influence on the world. You may have a lot, but it's still, I don't mean limited as little, but limited as in there are limits to what you can do. And Deus Ex sort of uses the limitation inherent with games to explore that idea, and that you're going to have certain, even assuming that you're the one who gets to make the choice isn't how do I want this to happen. The choice is, which way of those available do I want this to happen?
Yeah, and
and so the villain in that sense, you could see, again, an environmental villain in the limitations of individual choice.
Right, and I mean, I think Portal's another great example of that, where the villain in, I know that's weird to say, because the villain's clearly GLaDOS. Is she really a villain, though? But you're stuck. You don't have any choice but to solve the puzzles. I mean, the choice has largely been removed from you from any of your actions. And in fact, both games really end with you having no control over your destiny. I mean, no matter what you do, no matter how good you are at it, you cannot escape. And GLaDOS, for better or for worse, is just the personification of human nature. It's being alive without having a conscience, so to speak. Because, and I've always wondered this about GLaDOS, is part of a problem that she doesn't have a conscience, or is part of a problem is because as a computer, she immediately answers her conscience. So when you see a lot of people talk about like guilt or doubt, that's their conscience asking, well, did I really do the right thing about some past action that you've reflected upon? But as a computer, they would never reflect on anything. I mean, all the doubt, all the guilt that would come, is there's never that moment because it's already been decided and it's next to computing the next variables. And that's sort of what you kind of get about the feeling you get with GLaDOS, is that she doesn't feel any remorse for what she did because there's no reflection. There's no reason for her to reflect. It's inefficient. It's pointless, so to speak.
And GLaDOS is an interesting villain because she is made somewhat relatable in Portal 2, which was an odd choice. I didn't think they'd do that. But they kind of added, oh, well, she's sort of based on this other person and she doesn't know how she feels about that. But then in the end, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really make any difference because GLaDOS is what she is. And then it also asks the question, well, who is the villain here? Is it GLaDOS? Is it the people who made GLaDOS? Is it Cave Johnson for coming up with this entire... who ultimately is forcing his employees into deadly situations simply because... It asks the question, I think, in two, is Cave really any different than GLaDOS?
No.
Maybe less effective, but he was a human who did exactly the same thing that GLaDOS is doing now. So is GLaDOS better or worse than him? You could argue he's worse because... he did have a conscience, but we do humans, some humans basically don't.
And that's sort of the question of Portal and, to a lesser extent, Half-Life, is science evil? And the question, and you see it in Half-Life, to me, has always been that the original Half-Life game set up that the alien invasion only occurred because of the portal that you rip open with the super collider or whatever it was at the beginning. I think it was a super collider.
No, that sounds right.
And then you basically, what you did in the name of science, for science, and you ripped open this hole and all these aliens came pouring through, and Gordon Freeman's kind of the guy who did it. I mean, so that's sort of the blame for that. And then Portal, Aperture Science, is literally just that. Should we do science for the sake of doing science?
We do what we must because we can.
Right. I mean... There's not a bigger question really raised, in my opinion, in those games other than, is science inherently evil? And part of the brilliance of it is they never give a satisfactory answer one way or the other. I mean,
because ultimately in both games, you're using a heavy amount of technology and science to fight back. So you can argue, well, the problem was created, but the problem can only be solved through technology. Is ultimately a physical manifestation of scientific inquiry, or at least in those games it is. The technologies are pretty heavily driven by what we would consider research or science. And it asks, and so that's kind of the concept of an environmental, again, of an environmental villain or of an elemental villain. A villain that you can't really fight. And those games make that point well, again, because, well, okay, so if you view technology or science in some sense as the villain, or the concept of uninhibited scientific progress as the villain, then wouldn't the solution be to stop uninhibited scientific progress? But you don't. You use everything at your disposal to fight back, and so you're kind of really left to decide, like, well, who do we blame this on? Do we blame this on the lack of care taken? Do we blame it on science itself? It's not something you can actually fight. What you can fight is aliens. And so you beat up on those as sort of a mechanism to tell a story that ultimately is about another villain that maybe you can't face.
And, I mean, part of the big sort of nebulous evil has always been the dark side of the Force in Star Wars. Was sort of like, it is evil and it corrupts people to do evil things, which was... the interesting tack I think they took in Knights of the Old Republic, which was really analyzed the nature of evil. and picked an interesting choice because you can view that entire the first Knights of the Republic game as being a complete dissection of evil. I mean, the entire game is, and once again, statute of limitations, spoiler alert, is figuring out why Revan did any of the things he did, how he became a monster, why he became a monster, what led him down that path, what is the nature of evil, and then the questions then became, at basically the crux of the game, is does the lesson that you learn is that, okay, the problem was I wasn't evil enough, so I need to become more evil to acquire more power, or was the question, or was the answer, well, at some point, evil only begets more evil, so you really should stop going down that path because it is ultimately going to end back to where you started, which is dead, dying, lost, hopeless, that evil doesn't really satisfy any of that. If you look at the Jedis you come across, it's one of the few instances where almost all of the Jedi characters in some way, shape, or form are unlikable. The entire Jedi Council is unlikable for being unbending, stuck in their ways, conservative. They don't see the reason to fight evil. Bastila is unlikable in the sense that she's arrogant.
Condescending
and powerful. I mean, like, if you really were that much better than everybody else, why wouldn't you be arrogant and condescending? It's sort of human nature. The other female Jedi whose name's escaping me.
Juhani,
yes. You come across her, she's basically having her crisis of faith. And you get that she engaged in some bad acts that she feels, you know, remorse for. And then the last Jedi you come across as a replayable companion is Jolo Bindi, who is pretty much like, yeah, good and evil are pretty arbitrary. And, you know, every good person has evil in them, and every evil person has good in them. It's a matter of striking a balance. But his answer to all of that is to not participate until you basically force him to participate.
He's paralyzed by fear. He represents kind of the problem with the idea that, well, we can't really know what good and evil are, is that you will be strongly encouraged to simply do nothing, because if you don't know, then you don't know you're right, and it's you end up paralyzed by that realization.
And, I mean, you pretty much get the feeling that
this is why he lives in the middle of a forest talking to no one when you find him.
Exactly. And is happy.
Yeah.
And you pretty much force him to join your cause. Pretty much on the promise that if we don't stop Malak, he will literally destroy everything. What you get is because he was always second best. I mean, the main antagonist of the game, Darth Malak, his literal complaint is I'm tired of being second best.
I'll prove to everyone that I can be even more destructive than Revan.
And you sort of understand that Revan made him that way. I mean, for better or for worse, that's on you. And then the question is, like, was Revan evil? And, I mean, the answer is yes. But the way that the game sort of portrays it is there's a lot of sympathy for why Revan made the choices that Revan did.
And then they go back later in the lore and really try to explain everything Revan did, which I actually think takes something away from the story. But basically saying that he was warped by the Emperor. It gets very confusing in how it interacts with...
I choose to ignore all that.
Yeah, the Old Republic, the MMO. Essentially, though, in Knights of the Old Republic, it is very much an exploration of what it means to be evil and the nature of second chances. You know, if you had it to do all over again, would you do it all over again? Is kind of the question that gets asked. And it was a very interesting exploration because you didn't see... There are plenty of games that let you play as the orcs or the humans and things like that. But most of them don't really ask many questions about good and evil, or at least not in that way. And so the KOTOR series was very good at that. KOTOR 2 kind of took the Jolie concept and went a lot further with it through the personage of Freya, who ultimately is another... It's another game where the villain is actually someone on your team. But again, she doesn't necessarily believe that she is the villain. And so again, the KOTOR games did a lot to sort of, again, take that... the concept of sort of a Well, that's always existed in Star Wars, the elemental evil, the dark side of the Force, which no one ever suggests is going anywhere. The dark side of the Force simply is. And you can't fight that.
And it's always sort of interesting in the Star Wars lore, especially in the Knights of the Republic game, is the suggestion is good always falls to the dark side when they try to fight it, when they try to stop it from occurring, because you can't.
Because it simply is. And it's tied up a lot in sort of the concept of dualism, and that to try to destroy evil is an inherently evil act because it's an act of destruction, and you can't destroy. So the only way to destroy evil would be to engage in evil, which then you would become the evil, so you haven't really destroyed it, you've simply moved it.
And you can't be better at it.
Right. So ultimately, the only way to fight evil is to hold the line. Which is certainly what the Star Wars movies suggest, is the Jedi stopped holding the line, and then we're all destroyed. It's almost directly what happens over the course of the first three movies,
the prequels.
Yes, the prequels, not the first three movies. You know what I mean? Episodes 1 through 3. So that's, again, an exploration of an elemental evil that you can't fight, and so it gets distilled down into characters or entities that you can fight. And you'll find that trope repeating itself a lot, especially as storytelling has gotten more sophisticated, because it's a little bit, I think, more difficult to buy that that there is just an entity that is purely evil. It's typically not a very interesting villain. You need a lot more context, and you need a lot more, or gamers seem to enjoy more context, more reasoning. And for that, you tend to need an abstract concept that is the villain in some sense, and then something you can fight that represents that abstract concept.
And usually, and the villains that people choose to remember or choose to sort of engage in is they have a level of sympathy to them. That there's usually something or someone did something, or there was an occurrence that sort of set them down the path they were on.
Well, my favorite villain of all time is an exploration in when that doesn't work, which is the Joker, who we have no idea why. He gives a different story every time he's asked as to why he is the way he is. The Joker, in some ways, I think comes closest to being an elemental evil without embodied in one person, but that was what he was always meant to represent, is chaos to Batman's order. So,
and Batman can't ever beat him.
No.
And can't control him.
And isn't interested in beating him, which is weird. Replaying the Arkham Asylum game, where the Joker stands on the edge of basically standing on a ledge and says, "I'll give you one free, knock me off, in this once and for all." And just stands, and you kind of get the feeling, knowing the Joker, that he means it. Like, fine, do it. You know, in this once and for all. Because the Joker, presumably, again, in true Star Wars fashion, understands that the second Batman does that, he's no longer really the good guy.
Right, and almost understands without knowing why that's what haunts Bruce Wayne, is the arbitrary taking of a life. That's what made Batman, Batman. And why he can't take a life is because that was the evil he witnessed, is the arbitrariness of just killing a random person for whatever reason.
So the Joker, though, makes a very compelling villain, I think, precisely because he is almost an elemental evil. He is almost just everything that is wrong with humanity distilled down into one person. Which is why I'm glad Mark Hamill's mental health is as good as it is, because you would think voicing that would eventually get to you. Maybe it has. I hope not, but here we are. Anyway, he's very compelling, I think, specifically because all the other Batman villains almost always end up working for the Joker. They almost have to, because they all represent aspects of problems. You have the Penguin representing greed, and you have Harvey Dent, who represents sort of the arbitrary nature of the seemingly arbitrary nature of justice, or the ephemeral nature of justice, if you prefer. Catwoman, again, greed-ish.
Survival,
sure. Poison Ivy, environmentalism taken to the umpteenth degree. Mr. Freeze represents sort of a combination of man's inhumanity to man and the consequences of cruelty. Love. Yeah.
But Mr. Freeze is love. Because he does everything he does for his dead, dying, deadish, frozen
wife. Frozen wife. basically dead wife. Creepily frozen wife. Anyway, they all represent sort of aspects. The Joker is just kind of the logical conclusion of any one of those problems, which is, well, if you love too much and you can't control it, if you're too greedy, if you care too much about survival and not about anyone else, if you do any of those things, the inevitable result is madness. And since everything ends that way anyway, you might as well laugh about it. And that's, I think, kind of the distillation of the Joker is, this is where it ends. This is invariably where it ends, and almost everything he does is to show Batman that. That's why he's an interesting villain, is he's kind of taken the greed is bad, and then one step further to say greed is bad because it will inevitably lead to this. to not being able to see to take anything seriously. Because to take things seriously, we have to have those contrivances, we have to have control, and absent that, this is where we end. Whether or not you believe in it, whether you totally disagree with my entire assessment, I think that's that concept is what makes the Joker an interesting villain, is at least ask the question. It's like, why do all these things lead to this? Why is he always in charge? Why does anyone care what an obviously psychotic clown says? Why does anyone follow him? Why does anyone do anything for the Joker? Well, because he's very good at convincing people that this is really what's going to happen one way or the other, and that he's just along for the ride.
Well, and how do you feel that that relates to a game like Final Fantasy VI?
Another game, for those who don't know, where the main antagonist is, again, actually almost an elemental evil, is a clown. And VI is probably the closest to just having the Joker as the villain. Kiefka is an insane clown who at first looks like is working for someone else, but by the end of the game is quite clearly... Well, and he was working for someone else. It wasn't exactly a planned deception, but ultimately he just wants to see the world burn. Literally, actually. He has a laser beam for exactly that purpose. So, again, he kind of... I don't think he functions as well as the Joker because I don't think he has the right subordinates. I don't think there are the right other villains to sort of offset why he is the way he is. He really does just seem to want to... It probably tries to ask the same question, but I don't think it asks the questions leading you to that point. And so in kind of Final Fantasy fashion, he's pretty much just evil. You just need to stop him, because whatever else he does, whatever his motivations, it doesn't really matter. Ultimately, he has to be stopped, because he wants to blow everything up. And you don't have someone like Batman, who's already sort of a morality tale in and of himself, and how you have to have principles. The characters, the good guys in Final Fantasy are kind of much more... willing to say, it doesn't really matter. You have to be stopped. The Empire has to be stopped. If we have to kill a bunch of people on the way, so be it. Because it's really kind of not focusing on the same question. But he did function very well as a person transformed into unrelenting evil. Because you don't ever really sympathize with Kiefer. You don't know. Maybe he had a very rough childhood. You don't know. It doesn't. They never explore that. He's just evil, and you just have to stop him. And so he's very similar to the Joker in that they go out of their way to never explain how the Joker comes to be. But I think the subtle difference is that you're led to the question differently with the Joker than you were in Final Fantasy.
What are some of your other favorite villains?
Oh, in video games? Let's see. I've never been the biggest fan of Sephiroth because he doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So I'll start there by dumping on everyone's favorite villain. He's really cool, but as far as villains go, Cloud's only barely a hero. And
you can almost argue Cloud's a villain in the game.
But ultimately he has a choice to make, and he kind of makes the right one in that he chooses to, you know, to support his friends, to save the planet, whatever. He didn't have to choose that, maybe. But he once you've entered mind control and things like that into a game, choice starts to get very fuzzy. But he ultimately makes a different choice than Sephiroth. And that's why Sephiroth is exactly what he was designed to be. He's just not... he wants to blow up the planet. You have to stop him. And so he's cool. And in that sense, he's a little bit like Kiefka. He's cool... but then they try to put backstory on how he went crazy. I think it would have almost been better if they'd just said, nope, he's just Just evil. Was designed to be evil. Fooled himself for a little bit into thinking he wasn't, but he is. They try to hedge it, and then the newer stuff tries to hedge it a little bit. Final Fantasy is a little bit more like Star Wars. It's ultimately about elemental evil. It asks questions about other kinds of evil, Shinra and things like that, and the appropriate... And, you know, so Sephiroth has never been one of my favorites. Who do I really like? Who do I like to beat up on? I thought Wilhelm was a very interesting villain in Xenosaga, because ultimately the entire story is about, is it better to move forward? Is it always better to move forward? Or would it be better to have an end to it that would lead to a new beginning? Because ultimately the bad guy, that's all he wants, is for everything to start over again. The good guys, oddly enough, are essentially fighting to, as far as they know, destroy the universe. For the sake of being allowed to do it themselves, rather than being forced into a, you know, kind of illusion of choice. And so the game is very complicated, asks a lot of questions about what do you choose. But ultimately Wilhelm was interesting because at the end of the day, he was kind of the what we would normally think of as the good guy. He's fighting to save the universe. He's just fighting to do it in a way that will basically destroy free will, but then the game is asking the question, well, did anyone ever actually have that to begin with? And if not, has Wilhelm really done anything wrong?
Well, and Xenosaga is one of the interesting games where we kind of talked about earlier, or you talked about earlier, is all the characters are on rails.
Yeah.
Almost nobody, I can't think of one character who ever jumps off the rails and does something completely unexpected.
You could argue Kanan to a certain extent, or perhaps even Albedo in a really, really weird way. Or I think he less jumps off the rails more than comes to the end of the track and then keeps going.
Right.
But it is a game very much about choice, and that's what I liked about it. Because normally, if you take out all choice, you would think everyone would get very boring. But it's kind of a story about how much choice is not actually choice. How many times do we say, oh, well, I have a choice, but you really don't.
And that was sort of my favorite character in Xenosaga, Ziggy. And, I mean, it hits the nail on the head. He killed himself. Only to then be reborn when science has the ability to make him reborn.
Couldn't even choose to die.
That robbed him of all of his choice. And, I mean, then his entire life was more or less meaningless until he assigned a whole bunch of meaning to Momo. And that was
his choice. And that was kind of an exploration in, well, he was the opposite, where it looked like he had no choice, but then it turned, you know, he could make one choice whether or not he wanted to get involved with Momo beyond just protecting her. And making that choice humanized him. And so even though the game is kind of about, do we ever get to make choices, another way to look at it is how important the few choices we get to make are in our development as persons. And Wilhelm represents no choice. Right? Basically, he represents kind of a theological, cosmological certitude that things happen. He even has on his desk something that he calls the compass of order. Right? It's that things, everything is predetermined. Everything should be predetermined. That is how the universe works. And that's kind of what makes him the villain in that game, is that he would take away or would argue they never existed in the first place, all choice. And that's why I thought he was an interesting villain, because he's ultimately trapped by his own philosophy. He has no choice either. No one has a choice, up to and including him. They don't really try to make him sympathetic. They just try to make him rational. The ultimate rationale is like, well, if we can choose to exist or not exist, but that's the only choice, and I choose to exist, therefore there are no other choices. That can only happen one way. And so I thought Wilhelm was sort of, for being kind of a very sparsely used character, he gets very little face time in any of the games, but he's always there, and once you understand him, you see sort of the true horror of what he's trying to accomplish, and perhaps, I think what the game tries to say is, and perhaps the even greater horror of what happens if he fails. And the game does not rehabilitate that. It ends basically with you believing that the universe is just slowly blinking out of existence. So, that's fun. And you're left, you know, somehow, maybe it can be reversed, maybe a grand expedition, maybe an adventure will fix it. But you don't know that it will. But you do get to choose. And so ultimately choice wins for all the good and bad. So I thought Wilhelm, the Xenosaga games are great games, and I thought Wilhelm was sort of the perfect embodiment of a villain who really pretty legitimately did not believe they were the villain. He's not psycho. He's not Kiefka. He's not.
He's not crazy.
He's not the Joker. He doesn't want to see it all burn. But his method for preventing that is perhaps even more abhorrent than what anyone would contemplate. So I thought he was a good villain. Do you have a favorite villain? Kind of a villain you want to discuss here a little bit?
Sort of my favorite villain is now has become GLaDOS, which we've already talked about, because
GLaDOS is fun.
Because she's evil, but in an entirely believable way. I mean, morality just is not a question. It's factored into her programming. We just don't like the outcome. But you almost get the impression that Aperture Science was created because they sort of maybe understood that there were aliens that would murder us somewhere, and we have to figure out how to stop them. And if you have to break a few eggs to make that omelet, then so be it.
Humans are a very renewable resource.
I think Deus Ex asks the question and then completely forgets that they asked the question about whether Helios is evil, which is also its central computer in the first game, which you can choose to merge with, which then implies in the second game that it's secretly running the universe, and it's even more horrific because there is no more choice. That the supercomputer's actually running all the conspiracy groups. And that while all these people are fighting around, they're really all pawns on a chessboard of a game in which there is no choice, which is the far more believable Skynet scenario than Skynet's going to create a bunch of murderous robots.
Right, because why?
Because Skynet could just have us kill each other.
Yeah.
And could control population by just manipulating a few events. I think that's interesting. I always liked Dr. Wily. I mean, in the sense that for a cartoonish villain...
Mega Man. Dr. Wily is from Mega Man.
For Mega Man, whose sole function is to just be the evil person. You almost get it in the sense that what he's really upset about is he's not Dr. Light. He doesn't get... He did almost all the same things, but gets none of the accolades. And he just wants somebody to notice. And
negative attention is still attention.
And... I mean, I always thought that was interesting. We stopped exploring it, and then the Mega Man games became a lot less interesting because we didn't really want to do anything with that story or ask any more questions. I've always been a big fan of Bowser, and especially when they got to Bowser Jr. and sort of distilled all the Koopalings down to one character of, well, what if Bowser does have parental instincts? I mean, like, how evil could he be then when he has traits that we consider positive because he wants to make Bowser Jr.'s life better. And that sort of became sort of the theme of the later Mario games is what does that mean? I think you see a trend now in modern gaming that game designers understand that the villain is almost as important as the hero, and now they don't know what to do. So you see a lot of games sort of sidestepping the question of who's the evil. I think Gears of War falls into that. That they ask some interesting questions about the hive mind and the aliens, and are we the ones intruding on their space? But then they don't really want to answer them.
And that it all comes down to video games. Oftentimes, like we said, explore the same as literature or movies. You know, they ask questions, they explore things that we might not think of otherwise. And we tend good villains. You tend to see a little bit of yourself in the villain because it's asking, well, you to empathize with them or you to relate to them. So that ultimately you can confront, yes, you have relatable characteristics, but you're still wrong, and this is why. And that's what makes them interesting, because it makes you think a little bit about, you know, why is this wrong? Is it still wrong if X? Is it still wrong if Y? And that's what makes for a good villain. Not every game has great villains, and some games don't necessarily need them to be fun, you know, to have the gameplay elements. But especially games that are looking at the story, the villain is very, very important, because if you don't ask any questions at all, then it's going to feel like a fairly shallow experience. And it's very hard to ask villains without a foil to what's going on. You need conflict. And so you can have the villain just create conflict, but for the story to progress, you need a little bit more than that. You need a reason for the conflict. You need to be invested in what's going on. The Assassin's Creed games are great in that it's very hard to pin down who the heck the villain is.
But, and they sort of... You hit the nail on the head last time, is they just borrow from history.
Yeah.
that was their answer. Is the historical villains are often very interesting.
Oh, very. And what they did is turned some of those historical villains, gave them an ulterior motive throughout. And this one I don't want to spoil too much, but within the first 30 seconds of Assassin's Creed, the game is about conspiracy theories. The parts of it that are set in modern times are almost invariably about you unraveling vast, vast conspiracy theories throughout history. That's what the games are about. And even then, I think to this point, kind of it's the Assassins versus the Templars again. You figure that out very quickly within the first game. I don't think we know who's in charge of the Templars. You're kind of led to believe no one's in charge of the Templars.
They just kind of are there.
That they simply are. And you have these other beings that have been introduced more recently, and maybe they're by, but even then, kind of get the impression they're not behind the Templar. Maybe they're sort of in the background, but that the Templars simply are. The Assassins simply are. They represent two different aspects of humanity, and for all their attempts to wipe each other out, they can't, because frankly they can't exist without one another, barring something that changes humanity, which is the conclusion the Templars have ultimately come to, is if we change the nature of humanity, then maybe we'll be the only force left. So it's an existential threat, but they never really distill it occasionally into this person or that person, but you always have the certain knowledge that this isn't even necessarily a particularly high-ranking person. I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm not going to change anything by ending this. And Assassin's Creed has played a lot with what makes a good villain. And what makes a good villain is someone who is understandable. The Templar do not believe. They believe that they're the only hope humanity has. And often you're at, well, am I on the right side? And you want to respond, well, of course I'm on the right side, because I believe in freedom and choice and all of those great things. And then the question becomes, yeah, is that enough though? I mean, ultimately, by your very nature, you kill a lot of people. Is this what's best? And ultimately, you know, the answer you're supposed to come to game after game is, yes, this is what's best, but maybe not by a ton. And that's what makes the Templars so compelling. You can kind of see where they're coming from is, our way is no more violence, no more murder, no more death. Our way is what everyone claims to want. So why are you trying so hard to stop us?
And I think that's a good place to end it. I'm sort of talking about villains and the evolution of them from cartoony Bowser type bad guys that are evil just because we need a villain, to more bad guys that are sympathetic or have characteristics of the good guys, which sort of leads me into my small segment, which is actually about the first Assassin's Creed game, which just real quickly was sort of like the notion that it's a new game I played, but I just find it hard to enjoy because it doesn't have the martyr control scheme that I like. And I found it harder to play it than I find it to go back and play Deus Ex, because it reminds me too much of Arkham Asylum, but it's not. The controls are completely different, and that's sort of what I kind of struggled with. And did you want to talk briefly about the Humble Store? And
Only to say that we're going to kind of do an abbreviated segment here. I may have more to say about it later, but there is a Humble Store now. Humble is very interesting to me because for some reason, I guess people don't... I think the problem is people don't associate gamers as a group with any cohesion, partially because there's not much. But I think Child's Play and numerous other sources have shown that, like many groups, gamers, to the extent that they can be identified as a subculture, are concerned with charity, are concerned with helping people out. I've gotten to work with Child's Play very briefly a number of years ago when it was starting out and was dealing with a local hospital. And I was very impressed by how, people who really have no other identifying factor other than they like Penny Arcade. And why do they like Penny Arcade? Well, presumably because they're gamers. Not necessarily, but I think that's where a majority of their appeal probably comes from. There's a lot of charity that goes on within the gaming community, referring to specifically to video games. And Humble has been another example of that, where companies, in this most recent one, it's been Warner Brothers, who's not necessarily known for their benevolence, who, you know, sell games for very little money and allow that people can get those games without paying them at all, effectively, or at least not directly, and giving the money to charity. And so it's another good example. It's a way to pick up some cheap games that you may have missed, and a good way to give to charity. The Humble Store is now experimenting with selling new games at full price, but in an attempt to give to charity. You also see things like Blizzard will sell pets or things like that and donate all the proceeds to charity. Star Citizen recently did a thing where they gave some money to charity for certain purchases.
MechWarrior Online did a mech for cancer.
Yeah, and so these are human concerns, and so it's not really surprising that gamers would be interested in giving to charity. But I am glad I'm not surprised that the will is there. I'm a little bit surprised that we have as many good vehicles for achieving these goals. And I, from what I can tell, Humble is a pretty solid one. You always have to be careful with charities. A disappointing number are, in fact, basically pyramid schemes. But Humble seems to be doing good work and actually giving money to surprisingly wide variety of causes. So there's almost certainly one that you agree with, and you might look into it.
Perfect. Well, as we say, go forth and do good.
Yes.
And join us next week when we talk about protagonists who actually go forth and theoretically do good.
Or do they?
Or do they? And we will see you next time.